Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, July 26th, 2022. This is the 19th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. Well, today I am joined by Tony Gosling, an independent journalist, radio host, and author based in the UK. Okay, Tony Gosling, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Hi, John.
Good, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today. You are an investigative journalist that once worked for the BBC, and you are also a leading investigator of the Bilderberg Group, and you're based over in the United Kingdom. To get started, can you give our listeners a brief overview of your background and your career in journalism?
Well, before journalism, I was working in aviation over here, and I kind of got bored with airplanes. I think it's one of those things you get into when you're a teenager, you know, or a little kid. And I just wanted to find something which was going to challenge me day after day. And also, I mean, journalism to me, it's almost the most interesting profession there is, because you're, what you're doing is you're using language. You know, this is the great faculty that we have as humans, which it puts us above the animals, and it puts us in that, you know, more important position in the world, really, of stewards of the planet, is that our ability to understand things is fascinating. And the thing is, I've found over the years, there seems to be more and more of an effort to control the way the whole mass populations think. And we are very much along the lines of George Orwell and his brilliant 1984, that's prescient. I do wonder, because he worked for the BBC at the World Service too during the Second World War and resigned because he said, actually, this propaganda that you're trying to get me to do, it won't work and it can't work. And he went on to write some of the best books in the English language. I think, you know, this is just a guess really, but through information that he got from a lot of people that were working in broadcasting during the war, that there wasn't, it wasn't, everything wasn't just quite as simple as people thought it was during World War II. So I got a job in the BBC in 1989, working in the London newsroom, which was one of the busiest in the country, somewhere called Greater London Radio. Which was basically BBC's London station. And we did lots and lots of, I mean, we had a lot of money. We had a big production office, and we had the ability to cover news in London probably quicker and more comprehensively than almost any other media outlet in the country, including the big London newspapers, mainly because radio was the first, always the first to get to the scene of whatever it was. We used to, one of my jobs, actually, first jobs there, was to just sit on the phones. And if something happened, to just get on the phone and find somebody on the phone who was looking out over the scene, or, you know, get somebody live on the radio who could talk about it. And then, of course, you know, what we found was quite often the national newspapers would be listening to us, and they would get, take their quotes and get their cues from the BBC in London. So that's where I started. I went on to work in local radio, different parts of the country, including Wiltshire, which was an interesting place to work, which is one of the bases for the British Army, and Southampton, which was the Navy pretty well. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of other bits and pieces of work that I did. But I finally got the elbow when I was working in Salisbury in Wiltshire back in 1994. And the problem there was that I had come across the abuse of children in state children's homes, which would link back to the owner of the children's homes, who was taking money from the state, who was the deputy leader of the district council in Salisbury, Conservative. And as soon as I started looking into this with a couple of other colleagues from the local newspaper, I found my contract wasn't renewed. And at the time, I thought, well, I was a bit suspicious, you know, is this to do with my investigation? And then later, literally, you know, decades later, the chief constable of Wiltshire was talking about Edward Heath, the former prime minister who lived in Salisbury, and his involvement with child sexual abuse. And he was saying that he was, the actual quote from the former chief constable, Mike, I can't remember his second name, but anyway, he was saying it's 110% certain that Edward Heath was abusing children. And then within a few months, he'd lost his job as chief constable of Wiltshire. But so that was my journey through the corporation, really, three or four years working as a civil servant, doing information for the public benefit, paid for through the license fee. And during that time, I saw enormous changes in the character of the managers at the BBC. The director general was John Burt. He'd been brought in after Victor Rothschild and Margaret Thatcher. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was actually urged on by Victor Rothschild, who's a Labour peer, as well as obviously involved in the banking family, to sack the Director General. And Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the BBC, put in his memoirs that that Victor Rothschild had urged him to do this, you know, as well as Margaret Thatcher. And so he did sack the Director General, Alistair Milne, back in 1987. And just a couple of years before I joined, and I was watching really as the changes took place within the corporation, where it had been a proud journalistic organisation that was independent from government, slowly but surely coming under the heel of not only government but also big business too, under John Burt and successive director generals and chairmen. Slowly but surely it was being turned into this kind of almost like advertising, government advertising and big business advertising news organisation it is today. I mean, I still think they do some good stuff. They do. I know many people that still work in the BBC and they're doing their best. You know, many of them are, you know, it's like a kind of, they have, it's like being in a bunker. You know, you've got to just do what you can that you don't lose your job, and knowing that if you don't, you'll just get people straight out of advertising will be taking your jobs over. And so, yeah, it was a very interesting journey, and it taught me an incredible amount about the way that journalism has changed in my lifetime, literally, you know, from the front end. That's where I was seeing it, right in front of my nose. And that some of the people who taught me my trade were some of the best people I've met in my life. They worked in, even in the 1960s and 70s at the corporation, producing some of the most professional documentaries in the world. You can still watch some of these things, you know, where they would do brilliant, incisive, balanced filmmaking and documentary making. And that's what I'm trying as a freelancer now to continue. Also very active in the Journalist Union, the National Union of Journalists here in Britain, as part of their new media council, in doing our best to fight some of the appalling legislation there is, trying to quash and squash journalism in the same way as the British government is trying to squash one of the greatest investigative journalists alive by the name of Julian Assange, putting him in Belmarsh prison and attempting to send a message out to all journalists. Look, if you start doing any real investigative journalism, you're going to end up in the dungeon like Julian.
Right. Yeah. Wow. That's a very, very interesting story. And you actually pretty much addressed some of the other questions I had relating to your career with the BBC and just working in mainstream journalism. I was going to ask you, you know, what it was like and what you learned from the experience, but you've, like I said, you've pretty much
I think this is important. It was a great fun job, and you know, you felt day to day. You never quite knew what you was going to come at when you came in through the door. I did a shift from 10 in the morning, which finished about 7 p.m., and every day was something completely different. I remember one day we had a bomb at the Stock Exchange in London. Just literally as I walked in through the door, this was announced that this had happened. And so I got straight on the telephone. And I got a big pat on the back from my news editor that day, James Cameron, because I'd got literally the first coverage. I managed to, after about 10 minutes on the phone talking to a friend that worked in the City of London, we'd got the live coverage of the police arriving at the scene, if you can believe that, by this very articulate banker from the Royal Bank of Scotland, who was looking out over the scene of the Stock Exchange from the opposite side of the road. So, you know, this is the sort of thing I used to really enjoy doing, being the first to whatever event it was in order to get the coverage of what exactly was going on. And so we did also the release of Nelson Mandela. That was great fun. And sometimes, you know, I'd also say there's another, just a, it might seem to be a sort of boring thing just for journalists, but I think there's How do you find somebody that's going to be the right person to talk on a subject? And these old timers taught me, well, there's two kind of main criteria. First of all, they've got to be really knowledgeable on the topic. Now, that's not enough. They've also got to be really articulate too. So if they haven't got both, I'm afraid they don't quite, you know, they don't get on the radio. They don't score. So you can have somebody who's the most knowledgeable person like Einstein, you know, but if he can't, or she can't explain themselves to the layman articulately, then you don't bother. And the same, you know, you can get someone who can talk the hind legs off a donkey, but they haven't got the knowledge and enough knowledge. So that's what we tried to do. And I think we did a very good job for them. In fact, we were the most popular station at the time, more popular than the commercial stations in London. We played a lot of music, but we also delivered the news to the population. And that, sadly, you know, that station was knocked on the head. I think around about 3 or 4 years after I left. But anyone who's my age, I'm 60 now, living in London at the time will remember Greater London Radio, GLR. We were, you know, everyone was listening to us at the time. I remember, in fact, doing a weekend phone-in once, and it was around about Christmas time, and we got some guy phoned in saying, oh, I've, you know, my car's been stolen, and all the presents for the family are in the boot, and we don't know what to do. You know, anyway, about a minute later, you'll never guess what, the guy who'd stolen the car was listening, and he phoned in. And so we were able to phone the guy back and give him the location of whereabouts his car was, so he could get it, go and get it back from the criminal that took it, you know, completely bypassing the police, who hadn't helped him and hadn't managed to help him at all. But that's the power of radio. You know, you can, it's almost like the nerve system of humanity. And when it works well, it's a great place to be. But of course, nowadays, it isn't doing that job. In fact, even as a punter, I phone into the phone-ins in London now, and they don't even let you on. They don't let you speak. You know, they've got to have somebody who's, you know, into the woke agenda or into some kind of nonsense that they want to talk about, and they're filling people's head with nonsense. And so, of course, most youngsters don't bother listening, and they go on to social media to get almost all their information. They don't bother with the BBC anymore.
Wow, interesting. Very, very interesting experience. Sounds like you learned a lot and sort of got an inside look at how like a mainstream platform works in the United Kingdom and sort of how it changed over the years. So when they refused to renew your contract, is that when you sort of branched off and started getting into alternative media? And when did you start researching alternative topics and quote unquote conspiracy theories?
Well, the Bilderbergers, got interested. Well, okay, so finishing at the BBC, I started getting interested in environmental campaigning, like a lot of people do, and but also social justice stuff. And obviously, some of the most interesting people I interviewed over the years were people who were involved in pressure groups of various sorts. And this group popped up in Oxford called The Land Is Ours, land rights and squatting group, really to do with gypsy traveller rights, this kind of thing. Because, you know, it was always. In the conservative Tory years, there had been all sorts of problems with, you know, laws to try and make things like parking on the roadside, which people have been doing for centuries, if not thousands of years, illegal. These kinds of things. So you've got to be moved on by the police or towed away and have your vehicles confiscated, this sort of thing. And then we had a big thing in the 1980s, which was called the Peace Convoy, which was hundreds of travellers that used to go from place to place in Britain during the summer, from festival to festival. But then they would also maybe turn up at a military base and do a little protest there. And that was clamped down on by the Thatcher government. Big time. So I had some contacts and friends there. And so I started doing land rights campaigning and campaigning for squatting for a while. But then I got back into broadcasting in Bristol and started to do my own radio show again, because, I mean, that's my greatest love, really. And the great thing about radio is you can just get anybody, stick them in front of my microphone, and off you go. And it was easy to do. It's very simple. You know, and even if they're not there, you can get them on the phone and off they go. And I think, you know, it amazes me listening to the radio nowadays to think, well, you know, you've got a whole bunch of people on the radio today, but none of them have actually got anything to say. Not even the politicians have got anything to say. I mean, I've just been to an agricultural show today here in the southwest of England, and I've bumped into probably or had chats with about 25 people, all of whom would have far more to say about the way the world works and of interest to the public. Obviously, the farmers are very important. They're our food chain. They've got all sorts of very important things to say about proposals to do with farming at the moment. That is, say, taking land out of livestock production and, well, even some people even saying that you should ban livestock production completely. They've got all sorts of interesting stuff to say, but you don't hear those voices. And so I got back into Bristol Community Radio. I also got picked up by RT, Russia Today, as well as Press TV, the Iranian channel, and other channels, another channel in Turkey, Ahaba, they're called. So I've been doing stuff, and the Turks would translate my stuff into Turkish, so I had to obviously have a Turkish friend to retranslate it back into English to make sure they said what I actually did say. And so I've been, you know, broadcasting ever since around about 2008 till now, getting back onto the TVs and radios and bothering people by investigating. And it's part of my nature. I want to find out what's happened. And it's no good, you know, if you find out and you only keep it to yourself. I want to make sure as many people that want to know about whatever subject I'm investigating do. And that's where we come to looking into the Bilderberg conferences. I was involved in a campaign and doing the publicity for it in London to do with land use. This is a massive supermarket they wanted to build, and the locals didn't want them to build it on the River Thames at Wandsworth. And one of the people that came to visit us said, oh, what about these Bilderbergers that rule the world? And I said, well, what are you talking about? But anyway, I dutifully wrote the name down and did an internet search, didn't find very much, but I had access to the Reuters article database for a few months then, and I did a search on there, and lo and behold, some absolutely shocking stuff came up about with press releases from the Bilderbergers, which said across the top in big bold letters, not for publication, with a whole list of some of the most powerful people in the world that were going to these conferences. So first thing I did is I just cut and pasted that in the mid-90s and put it up onto the internet and made sure that, you know, everyone else that wanted to see these not for publication lists of Bilderbergers at their press conferences could see them. And that's really how the Bilderberg.org website started. And it went on from there. Really, I had a load of research when I was living in Oxford at the Bodleian Library and dug out a whole load of history of the Bilderbergers, including the chairman, Prince Bernhard's, the fact that he had been a SS officer. And he'd married into the Dutch royal family. And then, amazingly, the British and the Americans weren't so stupid, but the British gave him a security pass and let him in on all sorts of secret stuff as a Dutch liaison officer because he'd married into the Dutch royal family. He was originally German. And Bernhard, you know, he was the chairman of the Bilderberg for the first 20 years until the Lockheed scandal in 1975. When he was found to have taken a bribe of $1 million from Lockheed to get the Dutch Air Force to buy Lockheed Starfighter jets, which weren't very good, actually didn't even last very long. But then he was in disgrace, and so they cancelled the Bilderberg conference that year. But the Bilderbergers really, you know, amazed me. This is where governments were selected, and to have an organisation so secretive that, you know, you've got they're picking prime ministers, presidents. So you see Bill Clinton, for example, come along to the Bilderberg, I think it was 91, and then suddenly gets the nomination in 93. I'm not sure the exact dates, but, you know, the same exact thing happened with Tony Blair. They're introduced to the world's financial elite at Bilderberg. If they like them, then they seem to have this magic wand waved over them, and a year or two later, they pop up as the leader of the country. And it does rather illustrate how fragile our democracy is when big business can have these secret meetings where the press are in there as well, sworn to secrecy. They're not reporting on it. They're in on the secrets, and they're in on the deals that are being done. And they're just simply not doing their job. And that, to me, I think, was one of the big eye-openers. That's why I decided to get that stuff up onto the internet, which was quite a new thing in the mid-1990s. And also it was an opportunity to get back into journalism, having been booted out of the BBC.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, that's really cool. So you were one of like the leading pioneering journalists covering Bilderberg. And when did you meet? I know you had mentioned before we started recording that you kind of hooked up with Jim Tucker, the late Jim Tucker, who covered Bilderberg for American Free Press for years and was really sort of instrumental and breaking through the mainstream blackout of the, you know, covering the Bilderberg meetings to where now, I mean, you can go to Bilderberg meetings. I think it's bilderbergmeetings.org is like the official website where they, you know, they'll announce the meeting and then who's attending and the agenda and stuff like that. But for years, for a very long time, this was very, very hush hush. So when did you start working with Jim Tucker, and do you want to talk about your relationship with him?
Well, yeah, I met him, I think it was at Jean Val in Belgium, near Brussels, in 2000. And we just hit it off but I think both of us understood the enormity of the crime that Bilderberg represents. It's this, you know, the idea really here is that these politicians are not being loyal to their voters. They're in that meeting. They're loyal to the people who are going to offer them a job when they leave politics. And they may be also doing deals to make sure that the private individuals' businesses are getting government contracts. The secrecy just doesn't work. You've got the bankers and big business people, oil companies, etc. They control most of the wealth in the Western world in that one conference. And for politicians to go in and swear an oath of secrecy to the organisers, for newspaper people to do that, it's a total betrayal of their role. And, you know, it seems pretty obvious to me under the Logan Act in the States or wherever else in the world, there's no way that they should be allowed to work, do anything in politics. By the way, one of the things that we discussed occasionally, Jim and I, was this, the aspect of Freemasonry being involved, because I know the guy that organized the Turnberry Conference, I think that was 98 in Scotland. I did a little bit of digging into him and I found his CV on some article database somewhere. And it turned out he'd been the personal private secretary to the Duke of Kent. Now, that's the Queen's cousin and also the Grand Master of World Freemasonry, Chief of United Grand Lodge. So clearly, you know, there seemed to be some sort of link to Freemasonry if the people involved at the top level of it weren't actually Freemasons themselves. So, you know, this is another problem, major problem, because the oaths of secrecy these Masons swear make it really improper for them to be involved in any kind of public office because their loyalty is to the craft. It's not to the public. They're craft first. But when chatting with Jim, I think one of the most amazing things that he showed us how to do I was a little younger in those days, was good communications before the meeting started with the staff of the various hotels they were in. This is assuming we could find out which hotel they were going to be in beforehand. And he had a terrific knack of picking, you know, two or three staff who were working at the hotel who he could groom a little bit beforehand, you know, tease them up a little bit. And then during the conference, he was getting fantastic information from these people, specific bits of conversation that the staff had picked up, the Bilderbergers were chatting about, but almost better than having a bug in the room. You know, obviously these places all get totally swept for bugs. And people need to understand, because I've seen, I think there's a Canadian guy that covers the Bilderberg saying this, oh, they could meet online. No. The whole point of the Bilderbergers meeting face-to-face is because they can have conversations face-to-face, they can make deals, they can, you know, do things like that that cannot be under surveillance, that are personal one-to-one favors that they're doing each other. And this is the pernicious nature of this. But the other aspect is that Jim and I talked about was this Nazi connection. So you've got effectively well, it's frightening, isn't it? I mean, you've got big corporations basically running the show. You had the attempted coup by Prescott Bush just before the Second World War over in the States by these people that was nailed by Smedley Butler, I'm sure you know. We have had similar problems in the past here. We had a whole load of pro-Nazi establishment royals here in Britain, including our King, Edward VIII. You know, but there's been this thread that's running through British and American establishment politics over the decades, which is absolutely pro-fascist. That is to say, they want to run the country just purely for the benefit of an elite, and that the democracy, it doesn't really matter if it's a facade, because that suits them nicely. They have this patronizing attitude of herding the population around as if they're sheep or cattle. And Jim and I would talk about things like that. But I mean, Jim's main, I think, ability was as a proper reporter to do a kind of journalistic sting on the Bilderbergers at every conference he went and get genuine, amazing leaks, which we haven't really seen happen hardly at all since Jim died, because it's an extremely difficult thing to do nowadays. For example, the latest Bilderberg conferences, we've had a couple of years during COVID where there haven't been conferences, but even the last one, I mean, we only found out about it the day it started, and the idea of actually being there is very unlikely. But I think that should hopefully change in 2023, when it's almost certain to be in Europe. And hopefully we will get to know a few weeks beforehand.
Yeah,
hotels and things like that.
Yeah, this year they released it rather late. I think it was actually either the day of or the day before the meetings actually started. And the hotel itself was totally locked down. I mean, you couldn't even get in. At least from what I understand from some of the videos that I've seen from a couple independent journalists that were, you know, trying to get in and trying to cover it. But yeah, no, they had it very much on lockdown, and that's been a strategy that they've pursued for a number of years, from what I understand.
Yeah, but our strategy is always to find out where they're going to be beforehand, and if you can do that, you're a little bit one step ahead, you know. And the other thing, of course, is you might think it's not worth going to one of these. It's always worth going. Whoever you are listening now, go along to a Bilderberg meeting, because you meet so many interested, like-minded people who are also scrying, you know, trying to find out what they're up to, because this really is the unofficial secret government of the West, you know, the parallel government of the Western world. That's who they are. That's the people in that room. And anyone
right.
that wants to find out what's really going on in the world really needs to be there, you know, either in one of the nearby hotels, chatting in one of the bars nearby or whatever. That's what's tended to happen over the years, is you get a terrific crowd turn up. I mean, I've met some amazing people at these conferences, and I went to the conference in 2016 in Dresden and picked up a whole load of fantastic new contacts from there, of people all around the world that know about this stuff, that make sure they're there. And also, of course, I, as an ex-mainstream journalist myself, I'm always chatting to the other mainstream journalists who are trying to cover it and making sure they've got all the information on or off the record that they need.
Right, yeah. You know, I've come to view Bilderberg as basically like part of a broader international network of these like private think tanks and just private organizations in general. I don't know what exactly Bilderberg is classified as. I mean, it's basically like a private think tank, right? And, you know, there's major corporate leaders, political elites. And that's what's so incredible is, you know, you look at like this past year's Bilderberg meeting, you have top officials in the Biden administration, former officials attending these meetings, mainstream journalists, as you mentioned, academics, and others that basically comprise the global power elite. And they're all meeting to network, to coordinate, to work together, to get on the same page, to develop talking points and agenda items, and basically to discuss ways to advance various globalist initiatives, such as combating, you know, climate change, for example, or dealing with the pandemic, or, you know, the Russia-Ukraine situation, and get everybody basically on the same page, in addition to, you know, sort of cutting these backroom deals that you've talked about.
Well, look, back in the 1980s, The Economist magazine, which is a sort of, it's a City of London, Rothschild family kind of mouthpiece, which is a very, very, it's a sophisticated thing, because a lot of people think, wow, these guys are really on the case. Yeah, but you've also got, you know, loads of articles in the Economist are not bylined. So who has it written this? You know, what's their motivation? As journalists, we're always a little bit suspicious when we see an article that's got no byline. And it means, of course, that you can't contact the journalist to correct stuff, etc. You've got to go through an editor if you want to correct something, and it may never get corrected. But they did in the 1980s, one of their Christmas editions, they'd obviously had the editor was off for a week, and whoever was standing in for them did a brilliant thing about these big conferences, and they were looking at the Trilateral Commission, many others as well. But when it came to Bilderberg, they titled that one, the headline was Ne plus ultra. In other words, nothing more above. And they were saying that when you have been invited to the Bilderberg, you've arrived. This is the top. And I think it's quite absolutely the case. The very top, the financiers of Obama campaign, Hillary Clinton campaigns, the Goldman Sachs people, they're all there. And this is, of course, Henry Kissinger, another big one. When I was there, David Rockefeller was still alive. And it was interesting to actually meet him at a Bilderberg conference, to actually get the chance to spend 15, 20 minutes chatting with him as we were strolling around the gardens of the Palace of Versailles. Now, you know, he's very tight-lipped. He wasn't going to talk to a journalist like me about anything important. But it was just fascinating to get a sense of, you know, what kind of person is this? He was actually quite a friendly, gentle old chap, and very professional, but quite absolutely deliberate in that we're not going to talk about the things you want to talk about. We're going to talk about what I want to talk about. He's very good at steering the conversation. And, it was a fascinating insight, because you don't actually necessarily understand all these sort of super powerful families, mega rich, mega wealthy families that can, you know, they're the kingmakers, aren't they? They're the ones that decide, the Bidens and the Trumps, who's going to get even a chance to stand, let alone win an election these days. And I think we've got a very fragile democracy now in the West because of the power that these people have been accruing to themselves over the years, and particularly the financial power, because most of the, you know, first of all, the 2008 bailouts have left all these people who were basically bad business people, bad bankers, who couldn't do their job, that should have gone bankrupt. We bailed them out. The public bailed them out, unbelievably, because we were too afraid to see a banking system, the banking systems across the Western world and other parts of the world collapse. And well, so what we've done is we've rewarded them for failure. This is the problem. Yeah. If you reward people like that for failure, then they're going to say, well, we need to do it again. And, of course, they have done it again. They did a similar thing, in getting more bailouts during the COVID crisis. In fact, even more than back in 2008, some people say. So you have to look at who's really in charge. In fact, we had a BBC journalist, Jeremy Paxman, on the TV. And it was one of his famous questions. Yeah, but who's in charge? You know, which is a very important thing to ask that we often don't get asked these days. These people are in charge. The Bilderbergers are in charge, and they get to pick and choose where and when they get grilled and where and when they appear to the public. And so we're not getting any proper scrutiny of the people who are really in charge by our journalism anymore, which is a very scary place to be. The fourth estate is extremely important. Without it, you end up with a tyranny, and I think that's the way we're heading these days.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, and it's been like that for a long time as far as I can tell. And one of the ways in which they're able to, you know, to control the public and to keep this information from them is by using weaponized terms like quote-unquote conspiracy theories. And you actually had – I mean, this was well after, you stopped working with the BBC, but you were actually on a program with Andrew Neil, who, if I'm not mistaken, is kind of like a longtime presenter for the BBC. And also a guy called David Aronovich, who's like a mainstream journalists in the United Kingdom, one of the top columnists. He's a guy with a Jewish background. And you were on a panel discussing the concept of conspiracy theories, right? Which I thought was very interesting. This was back in, I think, 2014. You want to talk about that briefly? And just the way, like, the mainstream covers quote-unquote conspiracy theories, which is
they pulled me on to a live network TV program. Andrew Neil, I think, I've got actually a lot of respect for. Boris Johnson refused to be interviewed by him because he knew that it might be bad for his election hopes. This is a few years ago. This is in the 2019 election. But Aronovich is really a professional shill, I would suggest. He's written books about subjects that he pretends to know about, but he doesn't know anything about it. In that particular interview, I remember pointing out a book, which is a terrific book about conspiracy theories, called Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. It's a kind of coffee table book where you've got every page has got another conspiracy, and he puts enough evidence in there for you to go and check the facts for yourself. But you can open it at any page, you'll find something you think, good God, is this really true? And he never even heard of the book, even though he just brought out a book himself all about conspiracy theories. He'd never heard of it. So these people are wheeled out in front of us, but they actually don't really know what they're talking about. They're there for a specific purpose, which is to, I suppose, dumb down the population in a to give a fake version of whatever it is. So, I mean, for example, we had a report out in the news just over this last week about the British Labour Party, how it was undermined from within during the 2017 election campaign where Jeremy Corbyn was standing. And he did very well in the campaign. And, you know, the obvious matter is, well, if he hadn't been undermined, he probably would have won from within his own party. And so that what they do is they'll wheel out somebody to talk about this, but in a very much a limited hangout fashion. So you'll hear a little bit about it, but you won't hear the key points, such as that I've just told you. Well, that, you know, Corbyn only just lost that election. So if he hadn't been undermined, he may have won it. So does that mean we live in a democracy or not? And if these people aren't punished, are they going to do it again? These are the sorts of ramifications of something like that that are just not looked into. And that's what I try and do every week on the radio program that I do. I mean, we call it a radio program. Really, it's a live podcast online in Bristol. Every week we do about 3 hours looking into local news, national news, international news. I mean, for example, just the week I'm chatting to you now, we're looking at the Russian announcement that they're extending their interest in Ukraine beyond the Donbass and trying to analyse why that might be. Is it these new long-range missiles that have been brought in, supplied by NATO countries for the Ukrainian government, or is it just simply the Russians pushing to desperately to try and get Zelensky and the Ukrainians to negotiate, which is something which is almost like banging your head against a brick wall? You're not going to get any kind of worthwhile negotiations with the Americans, the British, the NATO countries, the Ukrainians. I just think they're, you know, they're still trying, even though they don't think they can get anywhere. We look at aspects such as that, and also comparing that with the negotiations that have been going on in Tehran between Erdogan, Putin, and the Iranian president, where they've actually made progress in those talks towards peace in Syria, for example. So, you know, there are some talks which you can make peace. I think, is it Putin that said that he didn't think the Americans or the British were deal ready? So, you know, there wasn't really any point in talking to someone if they're not ready to make a deal. We'll wait until they're ready to make a deal, then we'll talk to them. And of course, that's why we've got this confrontation now, this kind of new Cold War that's broken out in Europe, which a lot of Europeans are suggesting. Do we really want to have a war here in Europe, which seems to be, we seem to be being egged on to have one by the Americans? Well, it's all right for them. You know, 4,000 miles away from Europe. But we don't really want to have a war here. So there's all sorts of, questions being asked about what the hell is going on in Ukraine at the moment. Because anyway, so that's what I do each week. It's thisweek.org.uk. If your listeners want to tune out, you've even got an app now. If you go to the App Store, not the BCFM Politics Show, it's called. And if you find that, you can, it will remind you every Friday, which should be around about, I think it's about midday your time. The show comes on live. And if you miss it, you can just download an MP3 and have a little bit of a listen. But I'm trying to make sure that we're doing the analysis every week, Sean. I mean, absolutely sure that at least there's something out there that isn't a limited hangout. Well, I know, is it Whitney Webb, I think, that coined the phrase unlimited hangout. And she's fantastic. She does that exact job, which is to push things as far as they'll go without any sort of hidden agendas. And there seems to be quite a lot of money out there for these kind of controlled opposition individuals out there who are attracting a lot of having had a chat to someone who was quite close to people in the security services in London. I could tell you there's a lot of time and effort that the security services in Britain put in anyway. I don't know about the States, probably the same, put into what they call in the trade nutter magnets. So they put out all sorts of information, which is absolutely true, very, very interesting. But they mix that, a toxic mix, with complete and utter nonsense as well. So those are the nutter magnets. Watch out for them. Be very discerning about where you're getting your news, because, there's, you know, as usual, the powers that be, the globalists, the New World Order, whatever you want to call them, they want to control both sides of the chessboard. So they make quite a lot of effort to put people in our camp as well.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. That's something that's been going on, again, for quite a long time, just watching the way the independent alternatives and seeing some of the limited hangouts and stuff like that. And it's very confusing. It's tough to get to the bottom of things. You know, you really got to put in a lot of work to really figure things out. And that kind of goes into the next topic I want to bring up, just the state of free speech and the state of independent journalism and political dissent in the United Kingdom today. I mean, I've seen reports over the years of dissidents in the United Kingdom being targeted and like arrested by the state for social media posts, for setting up a blog or a website or creating a podcast or a video that challenges, you know, mainstream politics or mainstream history. There's a guy that I follow called Sven Longshanks, who founded Radio Albion, which is like this very interesting podcasting network that I followed for several years. And I know he's been in like legal trouble recently, which we actually covered in American Free Press in I think two issues ago. So, I mean, I find this very, very concerning. I mean, you might not necessarily agree with everything that comes out on, you know, a platform like Radio Albion, for example, but for this man to be arrested simply for, you know, engaging in free speech and in free historical and political inquiry, I find outrageous. And, you know, again, I've seen reports over the years of people getting arrested for making a post on Facebook, for example, for, you know, criticizing mass immigration into the United Kingdom, or for, you know, criticizing a politician, for example. It's really, really concerning. And I'm curious what you think about the matter.
Well, yeah, okay. So what's happening on many levels, including the Julian Assange level, they're trying to make scapegoats. And the people that get criticized by the independent press and even by the mainstream press occasionally, what they try and do is, say, for example, if there's a mainstream journalist that does an article about somebody powerful like Prince Charles that shows him in a bad light, for example, the Sunday Times was revealing a few weeks ago that Prince Charles had been taking suitcases full of cash for his one of his charities, because they obviously didn't want to make sure that it wasn't observed, and that money could just go simply into whatever bank accounts that the Prince Charles wanted it to go into without it being properly tracked as a million dollars worth of. Or £1 million, I can't remember, one or the other, of money coming into the country from Saudi Arabia, and another load of money from Qatar. You know, these sorts of things will get journalists targeted one way or another. And I think that's been the same throughout history. Anybody powerful that is like someone like him, who has a lot of money to spend on lawyers, etc., will tend to have a go at the journalists concerned. But you're right, there is also an attempt at quashing freedom of speech amongst ordinary bloggers, because now, you know, what you're finding is with people like Craig Murray, he's one of the most respected bloggers in Britain. He's a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, and he was also very much involved in covering the Julian Assange trial for the family and for the whole nation, doing a much more detailed blog than any of the mainstream press were doing. And he was then targeted for something completely different and jailed, I think, for 6 months up in Scotland. So there has been, you know, it's obviously an embarrassment about the truth getting out in Britain. But we are, I think, a fairly dogged lot. And even if some of us do go to jail for short periods of time, or obviously with Julian, it may be longer. And, you know, he hasn't even started his sentence yet, you know, that which is horrific. But he's a very brave lad, chap. Very brave guy that's decided to absolutely take the system on in every way he possibly can. You know, and it is appalling that, you know, a country which is quite famous for its support for freedom of speech and for decent journalism over the centuries here in Britain, with, you know, these papers of record like the Times of London, and actually the BBC pre-1990s did a very, very good job in, you know, defending freedom of the press and fighting the government or police, etc., when they tried to control the news. That we seem to be being, you know, certainly under assault. We've got this thing coming along at the moment called the Online Safety Bill, which is going to, in some cases, possibly even criminalise things that people say which are considered by the government and by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport to be harmful or offensive. So they're starting to try and get rid of freedom of speech. Now, to be quite frank with you, I don't think they're going to succeed. You know, where we've got the internet, they can't arrest everybody. We've got a journalist union over here who are pretty strong. I mean, I'm also part of a group of about 25 journalists, including US and continental journalists, and in fact, even from New Zealand. We've got somebody from New Zealand called Holding the Line. Our website is holding-the-line.com. the-line.com. And what we're doing is we were just prompted by the absolutely appalling lies being told through the mass media during the COVID pandemic that, you know, we are just not simply not going to put up with this kind of nonsense. And the idea that you can actually criminalize the truth, censor the truth. I mean, I lost my own weekly radio show I've been doing for 12 years in the city of Bristol, that famous city where John Cabot sailed off to discover Newfoundland, supposedly discover it anyway, as if the Phoenicians or the North Americans, Indians, had not discovered that part of the world beforehand, you know, and bring so-called British civilization to North America. In our city, I was broadcasting here for 12 years, and when the COVID business started, we've got a Blairite Labour mayor in Bristol called Marvin Rees, one of his best mates, a guy called Patrick Hart. He was running the community radio station. He just booted me off the station. He said, oh, it'd be all because of COVID. And then, of course, that was just an excuse to remove, you know, an investigative journalist that had been quite critical and, in fact, dug up some rather embarrassing stories about his mate, the mayor of Bristol. So, you know, we still always have an outlet somewhere. And, I mean, you can't do this in China. You can do it in the West, which is you can just pick up a phone and get on a phone in. It's not so easy on the BBC these days. So, you know, this is one thing about I've always loved about radio is the immediacy of it. And the fact that, I mean, I do this sometimes myself, John. If I'm finding it difficult or impossible to get a story out to a bigger audience as I think it's necessary, such as over these green taxes they've been quietly bringing in on, you know, 20 pence on diesel, 20 pence on petrol over Christmas, which the oil companies did a camouflage for. So as the new tax came in, they dropped their price by an equivalent amount, so no one would notice the difference in price overnight. And once when that happened, I just thought, let's get on a national phone-in. So that's what I did. And I just jumped onto one of the national phone-ins and started to discuss it with one of their. And, of course, I've got all the facts to back it up. I can then record that, retweet it, get it out there. So, you know, there are ways to get stuff out, and at least it's not quite like China yet, where if you say something like I don't really agree, that I think the President Xi might have got it wrong, you're going to get a knock on the door. I don't think we're quite gone that far yet, thank God.
Right, yeah, but we certainly seem to be heading in that direction, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, but we need to keep pushing. That's what I'm saying, all the time. You know, I think you've got to, every time you see something which is crooked or corrupt about those in power. I mean, I'm not interested in people who are poor or weak. I'm not interested in doing stories, you know, exposing them. Any idiot can do that. What you need to do is find the people who are really in charge. We're talking about the, you know, sort of financial elite, the power elite, your famous sociologist C. Wright Mills did this brilliant book in the 1950s exposing who these people are, you know, these people who have got ideas beyond their station, who see the government and democratically elected bodies and the press as just an inconvenience in the way that they can destroy, take down, buy up, close down, you know, take over. You know, it's like I can remember another journalist friend, Finian Cunningham, who did a lot of work for RT, an Irish journal. He was talking about nowadays it's banks, not tanks. So they don't take things over by force. They just undermine you using lawyers, and they buy up whole industries, whole businesses. You know, obviously American Free Press is independent, and it's funded by its you know, its readers, etc. So you have that degree of autonomy, but you know, the mass media isn't like that, and a lot of it just simply gets taken out and taken down by the financial forces. And we you know, we've been seeing, actually, I think, a kind of coup going on against Boris Johnson over the last few weeks, with him being taken out by the same financial interests that are, you know, behind putting people like Biden in power. And I mean, we as Brits look over at Biden and think, well, this guy can hardly string two words together. He's on record as talking about getting the prosecutor in Ukraine sacked. He was filmed, for goodness sake, talking about that at the, I think it was at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's got a backdrop there where he's talking about, you know, this is how I got my son off criminal charges in Ukraine. I threatened to withdraw a $1 billion loan to the Ukrainian president, and within an hour they'd sacked the chief prosecutor of Ukraine. So this is gangster tactics that Biden's using, and quite clearly someone is patting him on the back thinking, if you can use tactics like that when you're vice president, well, let's make you president. And of course he hasn't really got much of a faculty of his of his own. He will say whatever he's told to say. In fact, we've also seen these pictures of these cue cards. He's just given these things. If they ask you a question about this, use this sentence to answer. He can't even think for himself. I mean, the guy's basically on the edge of senility, and yet he's got his finger over the most powerful nuclear button in history. So I think we're moving more and more towards a kind of dangerous world. And what bothers me is that Boris Johnson, who is a man who actually can think for himself and think on his feet, he's a good journalist, may now just simply be, well, it's almost certain that by the end of August, beginning of September, we're going to have a Goldman Sachs City of London puppet even replacing Boris Johnson.
Yeah, you know, I wanted you to talk about that, actually, because I know he was just he basically stepped down, right? I'm not sure exactly how it works. I know it's a little bit different in the United Kingdom, the way the prime ministership works, for example. But talk about that. I mean, was this – it sounds like you basically view it as almost like a deep state coup against him, right?
Well,
I don't know the details.
Yeah, a treasury coup, a City of London treasury coup. I mean, what happened is the chancellor stepped down, the health secretary stepped down. I mean, these are all the COVID people, of course, who were, you know, a bit close to the pharmaceutical industry during COVID. And there was a whole prearranged cascade of other ministers that stepped down, all over some really trivial matter, something to do at the Carlton Club, which is someone got drunk, you know. This is trivia. It's not a resigning matter. But Boris tried to stick it out, and he obviously realised that there was a conspiracy against him to get rid of him. Now, I'm no fan of Boris, but what I do like is the Trump-Boris attitude, where someone can actually think on their feet and think for themselves. I used to love those Trump press conferences where he's saying, "Hey, you, fake news," you know, because of course he's right. They were, and they were twisting and lying about what he was saying quite a lot of the time. But we won't get any of that with either Rishi Sunak from Goldman Sachs or else Liz Truss, who is just simply a Foreign Office Treasury puppet. I mean, what they just, you know, they say whatever's read out to them. And I really am quite fearful that these people have got their fingers on the nuclear button, because the military know, the banksters know, the deep state know that they're very easy people to manipulate, and they can put a script in front of them and they'll say whatever they're told to say. And so to have people like that, both sides of the Atlantic, running the show, what it suggests to me is there may be a war being prepared, that these, you know, deep state does actually want to have a war. It thinks that it can do well out of a war. You know, Naomi Klein and her disaster capitalism, the bigger the disaster, the more money they can make, apparently. I mean, obviously they can make money out of selling arms, in some cases financing both sides in a conflict, but then they also make massive amounts of money from the reconstruction contracts after the devastated region is, you know, turned into a wasteland. And so there are a lot of people out there who actually do want a war, and what better war than a war in Europe between the Russians and the Europeans and the United States and the Balkan states, etc. You know, so maybe the Baltic too. You know, that's another area that there may be. So that's the worry I have, that we're now moving towards a kind of deep state manoeuvre, and it will be. I think within a few months we'll be sorry to have seen Boris go, because you know he was a toff. He was a privileged establishment lad who's led the country to nothing but disaster, but at least he could think for himself, and he wouldn't necessarily go along with something so horrific as some kind of almost like an Armageddon style situation going on either in the Middle East or Europe. He would have railed against that and been publicly against it, so that would have been too much for him. But I don't think it'd be too much for any of the other candidates that are now set to take over from him.
That's very interesting, because, you know, I've been looking at Boris Johnson for the past, I mean, really since this whole situation in Ukraine has sort of spiraled out of control. And he seemed to be totally on board with the Americans and, you know, having this very anti-Russian, pro-Ukrainian attitude. So what you're saying is that the deep state wanted him out because he wasn't like a total, complete puppet or stooge. He's sort of had some initiative, some ability.
Well, he was also pushing
think
back
freely
against the green taxes. There's a big effort to push green taxes through. So as I was talking about the 20 pence a litre, which is it's basically a 10% rise in the price of diesel and petrol here in the UK. And they seem to have managed to have smuggled it through anyway over Christmas. But there was a cabinet meeting last year where Boris just refused to say, saying, look, and he did the right thing. He's saying this is going to cause inflation because if you start increasing the price of road fuel, then everything else is going to go up in price because everybody's going to have to start, you know, paying more for their food, for their services and everything. And so we're not going to do it. And I think that may have been one of the reasons. But I'll just pick you up on what you said about Ukraine spiraling out of control. I don't think it's out of control. I think it's very much in the control of the deep state. You have to look at the announcements we had here anyway last year in the autumn were, well, the price of gas is going to go through the roof. The price of fuel is going to go up. But they were talking about enormous increases in the price of gas last autumn. And I was thinking at the time, well, you know, how do you know the price of gas is going to go? Surely it's at a market and there's, you know, nothing's particularly going to happen. Well, of course, it transpires in February that, of course, yes, the gas from Russia is going to be cut off by many European countries. And so the price of gas, there's going to be less supply of gas, so it's going to have to go up. But this was, we were being told about this shock. It wasn't being explained to us 6 months before it happened. And then, of course, John, we've also got the withdrawal from Afghanistan. At the time, I'm thinking, well, what are they planning next? Why are they doing this? So they withdrew all these troops from Afghanistan. Now we know that they may wish to redeploy them in Europe. So maybe that's simply what they were doing. You know, if there was war, was to kick off with the Russians, having those soldiers out in Afghanistan would have been suicidal. They'd have been easy meat for the Russian military. And so I think that this was all well planned beforehand. There's also evidence the Russians have presented, which I imagine you've also seen, that the Ukrainians had slated the 7th of March for the invasion of the Donbass region. And they were actually massing on the border down in southeast, the Ukrainian army, that is, in southeast Ukraine, ready to invade the Donbass. And the Russians have said they've got the documents, intelligence, saying that they were planning to do that on the 7th of March. So that's why the Russians, 2 weeks beforehand, preempted that by, starting the whole ball rolling and then coming in behind the Ukrainian army and causing them all sorts of trouble. So, you know, in a way, I think that the West has quietly forced the Russians' hand in this. I mean, some people would obviously look at what happened in Afghanistan in 1980 and say, well, you know, the Russians have been just fallen into a trap here. But I think the Russians are now confidently walking into the trap, saying, well, we're quite happy to walk into this trap because we think if things spiral, into more and more conflict, then they have now the confidence to take the West on and win. I mean, this is what Putin's been doing since he became president in 2000, I think, is playing along with the West and doing everything he possibly can, bending over backwards to get along with the G7 that then with the Russians became the G8 countries and with NATO until now. And like literally this year, the Russians have built up the ability with their hypersonic weapons, etc., to take the West on and win. And now he's got that ability. He's now playing hardball. The other thing, of course, in all of this is that the Chinese will be watching Ukraine like hawks and thinking, well, okay, so if the Russians can get away with this, we're seeing the measure of the US power and the US force and the NATO power and force in Europe. Maybe we can take the US on too. They're a falling, you know, falling power there. And so they may be eyeing up Taiwan, thinking, well, maybe we should just grab Taiwan back. So this is enormous ramifications of what's going on in Ukraine. And I think the Russians have got a hell of a lot more confidence after their successful operation to stop the regime change in Syria. And also, of course, economically, we have, as Michael Hudson has spelt out, I'm not sure how familiar you are with him and his work, he's absolutely spelt out this finance capitalism is killing the host. Our economies have become uncompetitive already around the world because finance capitalism is destroying us. You know, this almost like treating money as, you know, I grew up in a world where we had industrial capitalism, where the money was to build things, make things, produce things, and that there were all sorts of areas where the finance people couldn't come in and just buy up and shut down their competition. For example, we had state-owned infrastructure, quite a lot of it in Britain, which just got sold off in the Thatcher era, and of course exchange controls, where you can get people from the Middle East buying up all your infrastructure, this kind of thing. That's finance capitalism. No, a bad idea, and it's actually going to
destroy our economies if we allow it to continue. And Hudson has pointed out, I think his book is called The Destiny of Civilization. It's just out about 6 months ago. The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism. Now, I realize for a lot of people, socialism is a bad word, but what he's talking about there is a mixed economy where you have all of the nation's infrastructure, including things like railways, run at cost, and public boards run by the government, by elected officials. And then you let the capitalists do all the other stuff. The infrastructure is, any idiot can run a railway system and make money, because if they're not making money, they just double the fares, and then suddenly they are making money, you know. So, but what we need is for the capitalists really to be the innovators, the people who are building new stuff, building cars, planes, whatever it happens to be. And the infrastructure, if the infrastructure is run at cost in the country, then everybody gets a level playing field. And we've also got a lot of barriers to entry in the market because of these massive, you know, people that don't pay tax, like Amazon and, you know, Google and Facebook and the rest of them. They move their tax things around the world. So we've got a real crisis in finance capitalism. And that, I think, is another reason why the Chinese and the Russians are looking at the West and thinking, well, these guys are finished, you know. Economically, right. I think they're right. Yeah. We are finished. And if we carry on down this road, where to allow the money people to dominate our politics, dominate our policy, dominate our military and our foreign policy, then I'm afraid we're kind of, well, easy meat for the Chinese, yeah, the Russians, and the rest of them. You know, I'd like to see our ability to compete with these people on a level playing field, but it's like we've given up on that anymore. Most of our elite, most of the wealthy people in our part of the world, they seem to see their own domestic populations as a bigger problem and spend more of their time dealing with people. You know, they can't. It's almost like, okay, so climate change and all that stuff, right? Most of that is being caused by China, can we take the Chinese on and say, shut down your coal-fired power stations? No. So we take on our own people, and we're trying to shut down. Even farming here, they're now talking about, oh, you've got to stop livestock farming. What are you talking about? You know, you're taking on the easy people in your own country rather than the big international competitors, because you actually can't compete internationally anymore. And that's what I think where we are right now.
Yeah, that's, oh man, all very, very well said. I completely agree. And one thing about the situation in Ukraine, it's really sort of highlighted just how fragile the West is. And that's what you see, I think, with the political elite in America, and also to a lesser extent in Europe. I mean, they are desperately trying to hang on to their grip on the global power structure. And Putin and the other Russian leaders are seeing this and openly calling it out and saying, look, you know, your time is finished. You know, this unipolar America-led world order has totally discredited itself. It's led, you know, to the destruction of countless nations in the Middle East. You know, there's a war now in Ukraine because of these policies, because of this American, you know, America-led world order. It's destroyed the economies of our own countries. I mean, it's been one big disaster, and that's becoming increasingly more and more obvious. Which, I mean, it's refreshing, frankly, to hear somebody like Putin call us out, because nobody here seems to be
well,
doing
he
it.
Well, he uses this term, the Empire of Lies.
Yeah, absolutely.
To describe us. Well, I mean, look, I have to say, that's what I see when I switch the TV on. I see lies. I mean, we've just had a whole, I mean, enormous, well, several weeks of attacks on a guy called Martin Bashir, who's a BBC Panorama journalist, who did a brilliant interview in 1995 with Princess Diana before she died. And that interview was all about what was going on in her marriage, you know, with Prince Charles. And it was a brilliant interview. We've just seen weeks of legal actions in the High Court about how terrible Bashir was, what a nasty, terrible journalist he was, how the interview must never be aired again. I mean, you know, this is like the last days of Rome. You know, our leaders, like Charles in this case, is just trying to, you know, clear the way for the succession to the Queen and get rid of any potential opposition that even a long-dead Diana can have through a brilliant Peter Pete BBC journalism in the dying days of the BBC. That to me, it's a lot of this is about how we do our job as journalists and whether we can hold these people to account. I think it's one of the most important jobs out there. But having said all that, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the humanity is quite a resilient thing. You know, whatever happens, we will survive all this. And I love Catherine Austin Fitz's attitude, which is, I mean, I remember hearing her recently saying, it's a war on God, and God always wins. And, of course, they're right. They're basically banging their heads against a brick wall. You know, they are trying desperately to cling on to power. Actually, power is leaving. The more and more they do that, the more and more power is leaving them. I mean, I've talked a few times about this idea of a parallel government, you know, the deep state. I think it's important to try and pin down what this is. And I've actually done an anthology, which is a printed book anthology now, called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is a look at, and it's extracts from all sorts of publications over the last, well, gosh, must be 350 years, really, since the time of the English Civil War, because the execution of the English King Charles I during the Civil War was, I think, one of the most interesting, horrendous acts. I mean, we had 10 years after that military rule by Oliver Cromwell, which is one of the darkest periods of British history. In fact, it was so bad that at the end of it, when Cromwell died, they thought, we've got to have to bring the king back. And they brought Charles II, his son, over from exile in France and reinstalled him in the, what they call the Restoration period, which was a bit like the 1960s. They had all these fantastic comedies in London. So my book, which is The Siege of Heaven Reader, which you can get on via Bilderberg.org or on eBay and places like that, it's an attempt to pull together hundreds of years of evidence of secret government right the way through to the assassination of Princess Diana, and, you know, even some more modern stuff. So I think what I've done there is try to look at this, how decisions are really made behind the scenes, what I've learned over the years about that. I also did another book which is specifically about the Bilderbergers and their origins, because Daniel Estulin did a book about Bilderberg, which was a big bestseller, etc. But it didn't touch on any of the interesting stuff I'd found out, which was all to do with the actual origin of Bilderberg, where the name came from, the battle in the Second World War, the Battle of Arnhem, which is in the film A Bridge Too Far, which is the massive British defeat, which certainly my evidence has shown was a deliberate defeat, that the British actually sacrificed their own troops to buy time for their German allies that they'd been doing deals with at that point in the Second World War. This is September 1944, still about 6 or 8 months of the war to go, that they'd been doing deals with the Nazis for safe passage for the Nazis, money from the Nazis, technology from the Nazis, uranium from the Nazis. You know, so this is for the there's quite good evidence that the Nazi uranium was used in the atomic weapons, Los Alamos, and tests and this sort of thing, and so those deals were you know, they were happy to sacrifice thousands and thousands of British paratroopers at Arnhem, and those people that were involved in that then went on to become, for example, as Lord Carrington. He was involved in the battle as a soldier. His tanks just did not move; they stuck, and they couldn't go forward and relieve the British soldiers at Arnhem. And that's portrayed in the film very well. So the book is really about that. It's about the also about. I mean, I did an interview with a guy whose uncle was a guard at the Nuremberg trials in 1946 after the war, and this Nazi general turned to him and said, "You have beaten us now for the second time, but the next time we will win, and you won't know what's happened until it's all over." And that was the sort of threat that was given about the what we call the Fourth Reich, the industrial finance capitalism Fourth Reich. And that's, I believe, where we are now. You know, we've got to fight the money from the Second World War that the Nazis looted from the whole of Europe. Went through South America to the Dulles Brothers law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, and then it was laundered into these 750 companies set up by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, over in South America. And they created a massive empire of transnational companies after the war, which would then be used to dominate Western affairs and world affairs. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that that's what they succeeded in doing in order to work together secretly. And one of the most devious things they did was to put Jews in charge of these companies, because no one would suspect that a company was based on laundered Nazi money and Nazi-sympathizing, SS-sympathizing shareholders if there was a Jewish person in charge of the firm. And that's one of the things they did. They were consciously doing that. A lot of this is actually reported by a brilliant US journalist, a guy called Paul Manning, who wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was his swan song. I mean, he was a brilliant journalist working for CBS during the Second World War. And so I take extracts from that. I also take extracts from a book called Op JB by John Ainsworth Davis, who was a spy for Churchill. And he was one of the people that was involved in getting Martin Bormann out of Berlin right at the very end of the Second World War, literally the last days of the war. They brought him out by commandos, by canoe, and into the British sector and then back over to London. And this was a, you know, the whole thing was very top secret. But I've checked all these facts out, and it all checks out that this guy Bormann, who was supposed to, in fact, funnily enough, there was even Stuart Stephen, who's a Daily Express journalist. They did in the 1970s a headline of the Saturday edition of the Daily Express saying Martin Bormann is alive. You know, they'd found him, they'd got photographs of him in Buenos Aires, they'd been over there, and then that whole story got squashed. There was a big attempt to squash that story about Bormann. Anyway, that book is called The Traitors of Arnhem, and it's really all about the way that the British were sacrificed at the Battle of Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, in order to buy time for the Nazis to make sure that they had all their wealth squirreled away in Switzerland, South America, and out of the country, because they knew the Russians were coming for Berlin.
Wow, very interesting. I have not read your book, and I really can't comment on it. But it's interesting. I find it interesting, worth looking into, to say the least. I've got one last question before we wrap up here, and I got to get your take on what Brits, and I guess other Europeans maybe more generally, are saying about American politics. What's the general attitude towards the 2020 election? Do most people think it was stolen? And then, you know, what do people think about our current president, Biden?
Well, I think there was a lot of Brits quite like Trump, in the same way as we like Boris, because he spoke his mind. He had a sense of humor. He took chloroquine, which, you know, quite a lot of switched on people in Britain know is actually an extremely good early treatment for COVID. Although the press tried to tell us the opposite, and the same, obviously, with ivermectin. And so I think Trump had actually quite a lot of sympathizers in Britain. Some of my neighbors really liked him. I'm not saying they had posters up, you know, but, you know, we've been used to having some quite awful puppet politicians. As to whether the election was stolen, I mean, in a way, it's a kind of a slam dunk after the affair, isn't it? It's almost, well, okay, this guy's in, you know, let's just see how he gets on. And I don't think there's any stomach whatsoever for the prosecutions of Trump. I mean, this seems like they're also doing a kind of double jeopardy with him, aren't they? They had this attempt to get him prosecuted, an original attempt, and now there's another attempt. It's almost as if they've decided he's guilty. Biden is a frightening character. Nobody here has got any time for him. Very, very few people. Anyway, I suppose there might be one or two who believe what they see on the TV. And, you know, we get a lot of spin from the US here these days. But in fact, we get quite a lot of US news nowadays on our TV. And I look at it and I think, well, this is American news. What the hell is it doing on a British? We even get American accents on the BBC. American reporters reporting on the BBC now. So we're clearly, you know, out of the Brussels empire. We're clearly now in the American empire. But I just find it. I think all that's happening there is there is an attempt in the US to try and make it impossible for Trump to stand again, because they're scared to death that now he's seen how things really work, that he might choose a different administration and be a much more effective president a second time round.
Yes, I absolutely think so. I think that's what these January 6th, you know, show trial, it's like very, very Orwellian, very like Soviet-esque. I mean, it's just totally ridiculous. And nobody in America is really even paying attention, at least at least the vast majority of people see right through this and see it for what it is, as this show trial, this attempt to basically discredit Trump. And that's what they've been doing from the moment he stepped foot on the, you know, the political stage. And I'm actually not even that big of a Trump supporter. I mean, I voted for him in 2016, but I've been very critical of him. And certainly a lot of the people that he appointed in his cabinet, for example, and some of the policies he pursued. And really, I think if you look at 2020, I mean, talk about a color revolution. America saw one in color, you know, saw a color revolution over the course of 2020. I think that's what COVID, at least to a large extent, was all about, was facilitating the theft of the election. And of course, to advance like the whole Great Reset agenda, which we see playing out today. And unfortunately,
yeah,
Trump played a key role in it.
From
go ahead.
The Democrat side, there had been, hadn't there, quite for a long time, there had been problems Democrats being able to vote. I mean, I can remember seeing great long queues of people, and you know, people not actually being able to cast their vote because not enough resources had been put into the polling stations in the poorer areas. I mean, the thing is that unless you're able to have a really good, fair, and well-operating voting system, which obviously the US has had problems with over the years, you're giving fuel to the fire to the Democrats to do all the things they did, which was to put every effort they possibly could into getting every single potential Democrat vote to count. And it may simply be that effort paid off. Now, the thing is, the Republicans have got to put all their effort in too. And ideally, what you want is a fair voting system where neither side has to put any special effort into getting those votes registered and turned out. So, I mean, I think you've also got to understand that, you know, you've got an increasing underclass in the states which just feels totally unrepresented, and they are bound to vote Democrat. And so somehow, if the Republicans are to do better, they've got to start appealing to those people too. You know, empty some of the, you know, you've got to get rid of so many people in jail, for example. You've got a horrific underclass over there. Those people need to be economic policies where those people can actually make a decent living without having to go to the local mafia or drug dealers or whatever in order to make some money. And with that, you know, I think you would see quite a big transformation in the States. Now, I'm not trying to tell you how to do things. So I think we need to do similar things here in Britain because we have an underclass now, masses of food banks. But I think at the core of all the stuff we've been discussing, a lot of it, is the conflict in the Middle East, which we haven't really touched on, which is, you know, this business between Israel and Iran, which seems to be getting worse and worse, actually. And both sides to making even more preparations for conflict. And my real worry is that if that kicks off, you know, you're going to see a wider war there, possibly the Chinese getting involved in the Middle East. We've already obviously got the Russians in Syria and the Americans in Syria, you know, so anything was to happen there would bring in the superpowers, and then that could really be it's almost like First World War type situation where you've got almost the blue touch paper. It's just a question of who's going to light it. It's all ready to go, this conflict. And that what that would do is I think it would discredit the faiths, because it would be portrayed as this is the Jews fighting the Muslims. No, this is the people who've hijacked the Jewish faith fighting people who've hijacked the Islamic faith. These are faiths of peace, as is Christianity. And I think that there's a danger there that such a conflict would be used to kind of bring in a new kind of pantheistic system where from that conflict, there would be world leaders would say, oh, look, these religions have been a terrible, terrible thing over the years. In fact, this was something which was put forward, I think you probably know, by Albert Pike back in the 1870s. He actually wanted to have various world wars with the effect eventually of discrediting the biblical monotheistic faiths, to bring in his kind of Scottish Rite Freemasonry pantheistic the system. And I think that looking at the what's going on in the world today, honestly does look as if Pike is going to get his way if we're not careful.
Yeah, well said. Well, Tony, we will go ahead and wrap it up there. Thank you very much for joining me today. This was a fascinating conversation. You are extremely knowledgeable about a wide variety of topics. So I really appreciate it, and I'd like
and
to do this again in the future.
Because I think I meet a lot of young people who are extremely switched on with a lot of this stuff. Okay, so the basis of faith church that I was brought up with seems to be losing a lot of that, particularly with the way that human society is taught in our schools, and that the basic Christian faith is not taught very well. You know, you've got loads of youngsters who don't even know who Moses was. You know, this is crazy. You know, we need to be teaching this stuff to young people, and if we don't, I do find that young people are very, very suspicious of authority. They're actually very good at reading news stories, you know, reading behind the headlines. And certainly if these power elite do try it on with wars, economic collapses, you know, listen, we've got a book of Revelation there, which is going to spell out how these things are happening. And at least if it does, you know, then we've got, a pretty good tool to guide us through whatever kind of calamity these people throw at us. And I'm always positive about these things. And like, as I said, Catherine Austin Fitz points out, you know, they are at war with God, and they're not going to win.
Yes. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. God is in charge, and we just got to stay true and do what we can to spread the truth and to hold these people accountable.
Correct.
So, yep.
Okay, so my weekly show, if I just run it, if people want to have a listen, it's thisweek.org.uk. I do a kind of 9/11 forum, which is looking at, it's basically a meme with lots of different threads and subjects. And that's 911, the numbers, forum.org.uk. We'll be looking at COVID, 9/11, goodness knows what, everything there. And also Bilderberg.org, www.bilderberg.org website is where you'll find links to the various books I've published. And also I'm in the middle at the moment of putting together, it's just a PDF at the moment, which is a book called The Siege of Heaven, which was originally commissioned by Chris Mulligan at Trinity Day Books, but then he changed his mind. But that's available as a PDF, which is a book of loads of my articles that I did for RT before. It's now blocked from Britain. You can't get RT, the website, like the Chinese did. You know, they blocked their website and we were complaining, but now we're doing it with the Russian website. So you can also pick up that book as a PDF at the moment only. But so it's The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is the anthology about secret government since the English Civil War. And the other one is The Traitors of Arnhem, and that is Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, and that's also available as a proper paperback, all via www.bilderberg.org.
Very good, Tony. I will have links to your websites when I post this podcast program, and I will stay in touch, and I'd like to do this again in the future.
Okay, John, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks,
I've
Tony.
I've joined you, and you've joined me, so I hope you don't mind me using a bit of that recording.
Oh, no problem at all.
Take care.
You, sir. Okay, have a good one.
Thanks for the call. Bye.
Yep, I'll talk to you soon.